Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Chevrolet. Chevy runs deep.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy and Peter DeLorenzo, episode 158 for July 27, 2012. Lutz Live. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website. Welcome to the special edition of Autoline Live. I'm John McElroy, joined by my co-host here, Peter DeLorenzo from AutoExtremist.com. Great having you here, Peter.
Always good to be here, John. This is a special show.
Very special, because we're at Bob Lutz's place, one of the greatest automotive icons in the history of the automotive industry, and here he comes himself, Mr. Bob Lutz. Bob, thanks for bringing us out here, or letting us come out here.
How are you, John? Welcome.
Yeah. So, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
No semi-retirement complaints. Is agreeing with you?
Yeah. In fact, I'm busy to the point where I wonder how I ever had time to work.
I can't believe you're comfortable out of the center of action like you were so much in your career.
Well, I think that's true, and I think it's better to wear out than to rust out, and we've all known too many people who retire at age 60 or 65, go to Florida and die on the back of their boat. You know, 6 months later, somebody says, oh, whatever happened to old Clarence? Oh, didn't you hear he died? You know, and God, he looked fine when he was still working.
Well, anyway. Let's walk a bit here and tell us about your place. I mean, this is pretty cool that you've got here.
This was bought, the whole area was bought for not very much money in 1982, and it was raw land. There was no hill. The hill that you see in behind the pond is basically what was dug out to create the pond, because there's an agricultural drain that comes in from the west, and it was causing this whole area to be swampy. Yeah. So we asked the real estate guy, well, I don't mind buying the property, but I can't live by a swamp. And he said, well, that's no problem. You just get a guy with a steam shovel, dig it all out, put it on the hill, and it'll cost you about, I don't know. I said, well, what would that cost you? I don't know, $35,000 or something. That was a lowball estimate. But meanwhile, it's a very nice pond, and it looks natural now.
Yeah, it looks
beautiful.
Looks like it's always been here.
Yeah, and that's, of course, it takes about 20 years to achieve that look. For a while, it before all the bushes and trees grew in, it looked a little like something that God hadn't created, you know, that was pretty man-made. But now I think it looks good, and we've got swans and ducks and occasional Canadian geese who are welcome to the point where they don't make deposits on the asphalt.
And you have Priscilla there.
Priscilla is the widow of Elvis, who was a very angry swan.
And what's that, a black swan?
Yes, it's I think they're native to Australia.
Wow.
She's very friendly.
She'll come up
in a sort of an attack stance, but really all she wants is to be patted on the head.
Yeah, she came up earlier and she was, you know, very insistent.
Yeah. Well, she wants to, I don't know whether she's checking you out or whether she wants to greet you. It's very hard to divine the swan motives.
And then you've got some pretty interesting cars right here.
Yes, well, we can
nearby.
Take a look at these.
Especially, let's talk about a couple that you've got right here, which, of course, you played a pretty big role in, the Chevy Volt and the new Cadillac XTS.
Yes. Well, the Volt is one that I bought after the synthetically generated All Volts Catch Fire flap. And as you'll recall, GM made the offer to owners that might be concerned to buy them back, and 31 owners did, and of course these then are technically lemon law cars, even though there's nothing wrong with them, so they have a so-called impaired title. and GM decided to sell them to employees and retirees, and I got one, and it was a very good deal. I've got 6,000 miles on it, of which 8 are on gasoline. So I figured out that that puts my mileage in the, 10 or 12,000 miles per gallon range. I love to drive the car. And it's more than just great to drive on electricity, but it's got all this wonderful torque, and you have a level of refinement that you almost never, you just can't possibly get in a gasoline-powered car. And plus, the ride and handling are very good. It's a fun car to drive. It's not boring. The climate control system works well, and then there's a lot of electronic toys inside, like you can select these different screens and see how energy efficient your driving style is and so forth. It's a lot of fun.
And then you've got everything else at the other extreme.
Well, yes. I like, you could call it bookends. The XTS is not mine. That was lent to me for a week or so by GM. Because I was interested in the outcome, obviously.
Well, obviously, this is a car that started when you were still there, and it's only just recently come out.
You'll recall, I think we had it as a mildly disguised concept car, and in Detroit, I think 2 years ago.
Yeah, 2 years ago. And it's heavily influenced by the 16
show
car.
I think all Cadillacs since the 16 have shown as much 16 influence as we could get into.
But I think this one is the most to me anyway when it comes at you on the road.
Yeah, well, it's that grill with the finer mesh that
makes
the big difference.
Yeah, this is the Platinum, so this is the Highline.
Exactly right. But I love this car. If you've driven it, you see that in terms of silence and refinement, this is the best job that was ever done on a Cadillac. And it's 325 horsepower. It's nice and lively. Shifts well. The calibration of engine to gearbox is very well done. This one's all-wheel drive, by the way. But, again, a very, very pleasant car to drive.
And, GM, Cadillac's on a roll right now. The new ATS is, I haven't driven it, but...
Getting good reviews.
Yes.
Well, what impresses me is 150 pounds lighter than...
The 3 Series.
Than the 3 Series, and, that's not a heavy car.
Yeah.
I have driven it, and it is a pretty good car. I'm especially wowed by the underbody aerodynamic attention to detail, which I've never seen in a mass production car. Race cars and other sports cars, yes, but not on a luxury car like that.
Well, it's amazing the length that people will go to get another tenth of a mile per gallon. And you notice that you really get the effect of aerodynamics demonstrated either on the Volt. When you're going into a headwind, you aren't going to get the 40 miles. If you've got a tailwind, you're going to get 45 or 50. And I noticed on the Pontiac Solstice the other day on 94, heading west at 80 miles, cruise set at 80 miles an hour, I was consistently, on instant fuel economy, consistently showing 34, 35 mpg. Back the other way, same road, but now a headwind, and I was showing 27, 28, which just shows you the overwhelming effect of aerodynamics. Once you're past 50 miles an hour, aero is the big factor. Rolling resistance is almost nothing.
No, that's right. The engine has more resistance to overcome pushing the wind than anything else over 50.
Sure. And anybody who's ridden a bicycle, of course, knows the difference between upwind and downwind.
Right.
When you're going downwind, you think you're Lance Armstrong. and then the rude awakening comes when you turn around to go back the other way.
And then you got some fun toys in here, too.
Yeah, this is this garage contains about 1,200 horsepower when you add it all up, because this is a ZR1. It's one of the first production specimens. 640 horsepower, and just a delightful, docile car to drive. I love the absence. Strange people say, well, don't you miss the V8 rumble? No, there's no V8 rumble in this. It's just silky quiet. All of the induction noise is soaked up by the forced induction system. And the gearbox is nice. The brakes are nice. It just, to me, this is one of the finest cars of any price I've ever driven. Just love it. Then the other two... This is a very rare Pontiac Solstice.
I was going to say, how many did they build of those? Eight?
About a total of 1,000 coupes, of which very few with the turbo engine and only four with the combination of turbo and manual transmission. So this is one of
four. So you have a very rare piece.
It is a rare car. And interestingly enough, a GM dealer up near Milford owns another one. So between us, we have 50% of the ones.
Monteverde.
Monteverde, yes. A Swiss car with Italian coachwork over a Chrysler 440 Wedge. There were about 70 of these built. This is a 1971 specimen.
What attracted you to this car, other than it was built in Switzerland, where you were born?
But that didn't factor in. I saw this very car at the Geneva show in March of 1971. And I was just stunned by it. Because if you put this car in the context of 1971...
It's a rocket ship.
Well, the proportion and the detailing, everything. Now there are some things on it that look dated. You know, today you'd move the wheels farther out to the edge of the body. I mean, but all of the cars of that era, even Ferraris, everybody had the wheels tucked. Look at an E-Type Jaguar, how ridiculous they look now. And I used to think, oh, God, an E-Type Jaguar, most beautiful car ever built. Now if I had one, I think I'd put spacers in and move the wheels up. Anyway, and it's got a beautiful interior and with the Chrysler 440 Wedge and the three-speed torque flight driving through a Jaguar independent rear end. Four-wheel disc brakes with the dual-circuit brake system, all of the modern conveniences of the early 70s. Yeah. It's a nice car to drive. Air conditioning works, and it's nice.
Beautiful color, too, that midnight
blue.
It
had been sitting in a field for about 30 years when I found it, and it was a metallic silver blue that was clearly beyond repair, and I decided I wanted midnight blue with the light tan Connelly leather.
Yeah.
What I find about it is such a low cowl and belt line and thin A-pillars, something that I don't think we'll ever see again, or not for a long time.
Because there's so many elements here that would no longer pass any sort of federal regulation, either here or in Europe. Look at the roof crush with those A-pillars that look like toothpicks and all that glass and the thin roof and so forth. So,
how did you pick the color, Bob? What midnight blue is it? Do you remember?
I don't know whose it is, but it was when the restorer just showed me chips and I said this one. You know?
Yeah, it's cool.
But it's going to the Hilton Head Concours in a little while. I think I'm chief judge or honorary chief judge or chief marshal or something, and they asked me to bring a car, and I gave them a choice, and they wanted this.
Sure, because this is so rare.
Yeah, it is rare. And this is one where, you know, what's his name from Car Market Newsletter? Or
Keith Martin.
Keith Martin congratulated me on the purchase and said, congratulations, you've just bought a car which someday will be worth $20,000 and you're going to spend $200,000 on the restoration. And I couldn't argue with him at the time. I just said, well, they're now not naturally well over that joking figure that he cited.
And then you've got some...
You know, even the wheels still look pretty. They're small, but it's still a decent alloy wheel pattern, I think.
And again, you know, considering the age of the car, that would have been bleeding edge in its day.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And then I just love the way the upper comes down. It's actually very similar to the Ferrari coupes at the time. Same designers, you know. The body was done by Fisore in Italy. But I love the way the little extraction vents are a continuation of the quarter window. A lot of nice detail out there. All right, well, over here we have kind of a trip down memory lane, and that this car is a 34 LaSalle, and it's identical to the first car that I have a conscious memory of when my parents in Ridgewood, New Jersey. My dad was working for Credit Suisse at the time in 1934. I was obviously 2 years old, and they sort of, you know, at the height of the Depression, my dad was happily, fortunately for the family, doing okay. So he showed up one evening with a LaSalle convertible. And I remember taking long trips in this, standing up on the seat, naturally.
And this one's got a mother-in-law seat, right? Isn't that what the steps are for on the side?
Rumble seat. Yeah, the three steps. This is step one, step two, step three. And then you'd step in, and it's richly upholstered, you know, and drunken parties. After a night of partying, they put four or five people back in here and three or four in the front.
Well, you'd be really... have your wits about you to go up these steps.
Yeah, right. That's the test right there. Yeah. If you can get in, you're okay.
And this looks like it's been completely restored.
Yeah, this one was. I'm having trouble with names tonight. The guy that used to have Cars and Concepts, Don...
Draper.
Dan Draper.
Doug Draper, I think it was, wasn't it?
Dan.
Or Dan? Okay.
Yeah, Dan.
See, I can't remember names either.
But, it was one of his first projects, and they did a very good job on it, and it does well in Concourse. The top is brand new because last winter some rodents ate a nice round hole in the top. This is one of the original... If you put this in the context of what other cars looked like in 1934. Remember, the full black fenders, the upright grills. I mean, think of a 34 Ford or 34 European cars. I mean, they were still square boxes. And this was one of the first efforts at streamlining. It's actually a Harley Earl car. And it's all the lovely Art Deco elements, like the little chevrons, the biplane bumper, those little air extractors.
This was Harley Earl's claim to fame, right?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
This is his first, when they created the art and color section at General Motors.
That's right, yeah.
For Harley.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This thing knocked people's socks off.
Well, this was a sub-brand of Cadillac.
It was a very clever thing to do, because during the Depression, people weren't buying Cadillacs. So they used LaSalle as a discount brand. And they were able to basically build Cadillacs with LaSalle grills and LaSalle badges and discount them heavily and let the Cadillac volume shrink so that the Cadillac image was never... And Packard didn't do that. Packard went down market with the whole line, did great volume for a while, but they lost their premium image and disappeared. So it worked for a while. I think it was probably right to drop it after the war. There was plenty of demand for Cadillacs. There was no need for the discount brand anymore.
I love the touches that you were talking about because they're so Art Deco.
Yeah, it is a total inside and out. Even the door trim panels. If you come over here, we'll show you the door trim panels. Oh, yeah. The way these are handled. This is all in lovely Art Deco, the ashtrays, everything is consistent. You know, it was a consistent design theme throughout the car. And it runs well, starts easily, and it's a nice, silky, smooth, straight eight.
That's the best thing about an old car is when it starts and runs well.
Yeah, not much. In one mechanical ad that I have put in, almost all of them, is electric fuel pumps. So that you don't have that long crank time to get fuel from the tank up to... So you run the electric pump for about 10 seconds, and then they start right away. This is a 41 Chrysler, which, again, I remember from my youth. This is when my dad bought one of these in 1940, albeit not a Windsor. He bought a New Yorker. And you could tell from the outside, because back in those days, when you bought the 8 instead of the 6, you got a longer hood. Nowadays, you just put the long hood on everything, and on some of the cars, it would be mostly empty. But not then. They did. The Royals and the Windsors had the short hood with the six-cylinder engine. The Saratogas, New Yorkers, and Imperials had the long hood with the straight eight.
Was the Windsor, was this made in Windsor, Canada,
no,
or was
no,
that
just
a name?
A series name. It was just a series name. And it's an early automatic in the sense that it's got fluid drive. So you can, once you're going, you can drive clutchless, and you can accelerate from a stop in high gear. If you and the people behind you are very patient.
It's slow off the line.
Oh, huh? Yeah. The 8 was better because it had all the torque. So here we have America's first 300-horsepower car.
First muscle car.
Yeah, and I think it was probably inspired by the fact that Briggs Cunningham with the race cars was getting a reliable 300 horsepower out of the 331 Hemi engine. And since Chrysler engineers had done most of the work for Cunningham on getting the engine up to that power level, they decided, Ford had done the Thunderbird, and GM had done the Corvette, and Chrysler had nothing and couldn't afford anything. So what they did, they literally decided what the car would be, and it's a blend of New Yorker regular line and blended with Imperial stuff. So the grille is Imperial with the two sections. The badging is specific 300, and the rest of the car in terms of ornamentation and trim was a blend between low series and Imperial. And the way they did, the guys at Chrysler told me, the way they did the first prototype was the senior engineers walked down the line with the car and said, get the Imperial one. Yeah, that goes on here.
God, I wish we could build cars these days.
Yeah.
And then you got some serious motorcycle. Yeah. We're not done with the 300 yet.
It is even today a very fast car, but like all American cars of the era, you transform the handling by putting modern steel belted radials on, because the old bias ply tires, this thing would, I mean, two lanes wasn't enough at 70 miles an hour. But with the modern, this has Avon turbo speeds on it. And steel belted radial, it goes down the road absolutely straight, and is a very nice long distance touring car. Yeah, the bikes. This is
serious motorcycles.
Yeah, that was my. It's not the same one, but I had one of these when I was in high school in Switzerland, and Switzerland at that point was a non-motorized society in the 50s, unlike the U.S. where kids had cars. In Switzerland, kids had bicycles, and I was one of the only ones with a motorcycle. And the reason for this is that my parents limited me to 125cc, so I bought a sports racing, barely street-legal Italian 125 that had more horsepower than all of the 250s of the period, and had a lot of fun with it. It's two-stroke twin with really a wailing exhaust note when it's in full cry, because they're glass pack mufflers, so they're basically unrestricted. This is the HP2. Everything you look at is authentic carbon fiber, magnesium, aluminum, and so forth. So it's ultra lightweight. It's only about 140 horsepower, but the bike is light. It's beautifully balanced. The engine, of course, sits very low. The handling on it is just brilliant. It's a very nice bike to ride. This is a K1200S, which is BMW's first transverse four-cylinder twin cam, to where they have to take the drive around the corner twice, which is why they, MV Agusta back in the old days, were the only ones that ever did that. And it requires very precise machining, because otherwise you get the tolerance buildup, you get driveline clunk. But because you really don't want to take the drive around right angles more than once. But they did it here successfully, and it's, again, a great bike to ride.
And one thing, too, I got to get you to talk about.
Yeah.
You got bikes in the garage I never expected to see. You got bicycles in here.
Well, that's because in my youth, being up until age 18, prevented from riding motor vehicles in Switzerland, I was a bicycle racer. And then I continued for quite a long time. That's that rally is made by the rally racing department in the UK. I've got a Greg LeMond, that's that red, white, and blue one. In fact, Chris Preuss, as you know, is a big bicycle racing aficionado, and he told me, he said, there is more value on that wall than you realize. So, and I'm glad to see that, you know, in times of extreme hardship, there's some things I could pedal. And back there, this is a K1 that was a very rare BMW, the blue one. It was BMW's first attempt at doing something other than their conventional touring bikes and to sort of put some excitement in the line. Didn't work real well, and it was very expensive. The yellow and gray one is a K1200 RS, basically sports touring. I'd say more touring than sports, but corners very well. About 140 horsepower. This is 182, I think. This is actually faster than a Hayabusa. And off in the corner, I've got everybody's training bike, which is a Kawasaki Ninja 250 that everybody learned to ride on. And then in the foreground, this little silver Ducati single is one that my stepson bought. And, you know, it's not what we think of when we hear the name Ducati, but it's an interesting, I think, an interesting collector's item. And it reminds people of the fact that Ducati wasn't always a maker of high-performance premium motorcycles. They were a mass producer of 125s, 150s, 175s, 250s, and so forth.
Well, Bob, thanks for showing me and Peter this part of what you got here.
Well, you're quite welcome. Quite welcome. I like it when people come to look.
And we got more to look at, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, we're going to continue on this tour right now, but right now we got to take a break with our sponsors and give a shout out to our friends at Bridgestone and
this
Chevrolet.
This is on loan from GM. It's a really
okay,
amazing car.
We're going to be showing you more of Bob Lutz's collection right here. We're going to be walking up to another part
Leave
of the house,
the
and he'll be joining us back here in just a second. And there's some other cool things to look at, some real collector's items. Not that we haven't seen collector's items, but even more too. So you've got to keep several garages, eh, Bob, for everything?
Yes, they're sort of spread out.
Now, I'd expect to see horses and dogs and all that sort of thing here, too.
The dogs are being kept inside so that they won't interfere with the program. And
right.
The last thing Denise said to me was, let the dogs out after they leave.
Yeah. Right. So let's talk some business stuff while we're going to see the next things. You've been on the board of Lotus. What do you see going on there right
well,
now?
I don't think anybody knows, and it wouldn't be fair for me to comment. And the new group that has taken it over has, in fact, as a cost-cutting measure, disbanded the advisory board. So that connection with the automobile industry and minor source of revenue is sadly gone. But I think a lot of people are asking that question. The new owners are basically a kind of a private equity group, and they are, I think, not inclined to put the hundreds of millions.
Okay, hold on.
Okay.
We're real interested in the business stuff, but
okay.
You can't go walking past this without explaining what it's about.
This is one of the world's most capable, you want to call it a 16-passenger sport utility, if you want, or a 16-passenger convertible, if you take the top off. But it was, for many, many decades, the number one NATO personnel carrier. They also made a six-wheel version with dual rear axles that were command cars, ambulance, field ambulances, and so forth. It is, the whole top part comes off, windshield comes off, tops of the doors come off, so that it is helicopter transportable. It's a 2.4-liter air-cooled four-cylinder engine. It's all coilover. Coilover suspension system, torque tube. There's no chassis, the torque tube. There's a hub reduction. So the drive goes in at the top of the wheel, and then there's a gear train, and the actual shaft comes out.
So tremendous ground clearance.
Oh, I mean, this will go, frankly, This should be labeled an Hummer H1 recovery vehicle, which it truly is.
Where were they made?
In Austria by Steyr.
Uh-huh.
And these were the Swiss Army ones, and
that's running condition, right?
Hmm?
That's running condition.
It's only got 12,000 miles total on it, and the Swiss Army didn't use them much, and they maintained them immaculately. I mean, getting one from the Swiss Army was like buying a new vehicle.
And you use it for just running around on the grounds here?
Yeah, it's like the old Crocodile Dundee thing. You know, you call that a sport utility? This is a sport utility.
It looks so cool, especially painted like it is.
Well, that's untouched. You know, that's the original Swiss Army paint job. The only thing I did was the wooden rub rails on the side were nice wood, so I had them stripped and marine varnished because they were just olive drab like the rest.
What a cool vehicle.
Yeah, and runs great, by the way. So here, this is what I call the aluminum garage, because everything in here is, just by happenstance, everything's aluminum. And what we have here, of course, is an AC Autocraft Cobra. We can turn on a light here.
Yes.
Oops. Somebody must have unplugged it.
That was made
by the AC Cars
people.
Yeah, it
was Brian Anglis.
Yeah.
And he owned the AC car company, and it's off the original Cobra box. The only difference the only change they made was to add 2 inches to, and it's got the original AC, the 8-inch diameter steel tubes as chassis rails. Only thing, they cut the tubes 2 inches longer to give a little bit more leg room for tall drivers. And so
Is that why you would want this car instead of an original?
I don't think I could drive an original. And besides, a lot was done to the chassis in terms of refinement. Steering, these are now very safe cars and very easy to drive, which the original 427s weren't necessarily. It was more power than refinement and handling. These later models, the 85 and subsequent, are very refined automobiles. And through Edsel Ford, I think the Ford Motor Company helped a little bit unofficially. And it met that's why it has headrests. It met MVSS requirements of the day, so it was street legal. But a very nice car, and it inspired the Dodge Viper. I was driving it one day after leaving Ford and joining Chrysler and feeling a little guilty about the Power by Ford badges on the side. And as I was driving, I thought to myself, you know, we could really do this. We've got all the stuff coming. We've got a heavy-duty 5-speed coming from the upcoming Dakota. We could probably use Dakota front suspension, which the Viper ultimately did. I think that was the only part that's of my idea that survived. I thought we can probably use the big cast iron V10, 8-liter V10 that's coming with the new pickup trucks. And the first prototypes actually had the cast iron V10. And then we switched over to aluminum and made it a much better car. But this car really did create the germ of the thought that ultimately wound up being the Dodge Viper. And next we have...
The Cunningham.
Yeah, C4R. This was one of the...
Awesome.
This is one of these... I won't try to... Tonight I will not be selling this car as an authentic 1952 Cunningham.
It's a continuation.
It's a continuation. I think it was Larry Black did those at Cunningham. And it's absolutely authentic in every detail.
And you've got a special part in your heart, I think, for Cunningham, right? I mean,
I
learned more from you about Cunningham than anywhere else.
Well, one of the reasons was one of my father's banking associates was a gentleman named Moran, who was one of the gentleman drivers on the Cunningham team and competed in Le Mans, and sent me a nice 5x8 glossy, which he had signed with him driving actually a C4RK, which was the coupe. And I always developed, because you have to remember, up and through the 50s, if you were a car fan in Europe, American cars were an embarrassment because they couldn't go around corners. The engines blew up on the engines blew up on the Autobahn. They couldn't stop. They wouldn't steer. The efforts at competing in European racing, if it wasn't a hill climb where power would overwhelm the other deficiencies, American cars were ridiculed. And then suddenly, Cunningham shows up one year with a specially prepared Cadillac coupe and did amazingly well. And then a year later, he started showing up with these. Well, first he showed up with the C2. Then, of course, the C3 coupe was something. But then he came with the C4 that almost won. The only reason, that was the year that Duncan Hamilton won in the D-type Jags. These were actually quicker. On the Mulsanne straight, they'd leave the Jags behind. The problem was drum brakes, and the Jags had the first-generation disc brakes.
Yeah.
And I said to...
And in the rain, the Jags would just, you know, yeah, the braking performance.
I said to Hamilton's son, whose name is Adrian Hamilton, he's a vintage car dealer in London, I said, you know, Cunningham would have beaten your father except for the brakes. And he says, yes, I know, but my dad did win.
They don't ask how you won. They just ask if you won.
Well, yeah. You've
got the beautiful Halbram wheels, just gorgeous.
Yeah, I mean, these are reproduction.
Yeah, but
so what? I got the repro kidney bean Halbrams on the C3 as well. This car is, this is a 331 Hemi, but using parts and materials that they didn't have in the 50s. So this is 400 horsepower instead of 300.
And what's it weigh?
Just over 2,000 pounds.
So, yeah.
And there's no trim, there's no carpets, there's no door handles, there's no window winders, there's nothing. No windshield wipers. I mean, this car is bare bones. So 400 horsepower with 5.5 liters worth of torque, 2,200 pounds, and the skinny R1 vintage racing tires where the rubber has turned a little bit hard.
With the 50s steering wheel driving position, too.
Yeah, the first, that was done for one of the American team drivers who was a sprint car driver, yeah. And he didn't like the vertical wheel. He said, I can only steer if the wheel is kind of like a lazy Susan in front of me. And they said, well, how do they do that? And they said, well, they put a U-joint in. So they did one, and everybody liked it.
So you're talking, what, 5.5 pounds per horsepower, right?
Yeah.
If I do my math right. So that's supercar territory.
Oh, absolutely. Except it can't get the power to the ground because of the small contact patch.
Yeah.
But you do, even shifting from second into third, before the tires are warm, you have to be careful with this because there's no stability control system or anything when the back end goes. There's no little electronic genii that get it lined up again for you.
And you have the beautiful coupe.
The C3 coupe made with a Vignale body. This was because the Automobile Club de l'Ouest, sanctioning body of the 24 Hours of Le Mans, said, look, Mr. Cunningham, we like you. And it's interesting to have an American here, and you've done a lot to propagate the notion that Americans can, in fact, build automobiles. But Le Mans is really technically restricted to manufacturers, and what you have here are individual-built prototype race cars. And he says, well, what do I have to do? And they said, you have to start producing automobiles. So there he did the C3, which is again, Chrysler 331 Hemi, either a Warner T10 transmission or this one originally had a LaSalle 3-speed or a Cadillac 3-speed manual. Front and rear suspension were the 1951 American Road Race or Pan American Road Race Lincolns. Remember those?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Very good stuff. So it's a combination of Lincoln pieces, Chrysler pieces,
Vignale body.
And a Vignale body. So the chassis was completed in the States, running chassis. shipped to Italy, bodied and shipped back. And so in 1953, this car retailed for $10,500, and Cunningham was losing money on him. Now, that was, you have to remember, that was in the world of 18-cent gas, 5-cent big Cokes at the drugstore, 10-cent movie tickets. So if you take that $10,000 and multiply by 10 or 12, you're not far off.
Yeah, and in fact, I remember the first Mercedes-Benz that went for 10 grand in the United States was not until 1970. So Mercedes is at 10 in 1970, and this is 10 grand in 1953. Unreal.
Yeah. No, it didn't work. But I remember when I was with BMW in the 70s, we had to price the Bavaria up. Because it was about $5,000, because some American cars were starting to get close to it. So we wanted to maintain the daylight, so priced up. And those, that's when Corvettes were $7,000, new Corvette. And Porsche's Speedster, when it came out, was $2,900. And then all the MG owners said, I'll never be able to afford one of those. And I remember getting my issue of Road and Track, getting it out of the mailbox, pulling it out of the jacket, and here's this cover with an E-type roadster and an E-type convertible on it. Now, wow, holy fun. Immediately looked to see what it was going to cost. $3,500. Not for me. Not something I'll ever be able to afford.
Yeah. Well, of course, if we inflation adjust those numbers, that would still be sky
that
high.
That was when I used to go look at houses in California with three car garages, huge patios, swimming pools, full air conditioned, and I'd say my wife and I would just cruise around and dream, you know, and look at these marble floors and full, beautiful kitchens, and say to the real estate guy, so what does this one go for? And he says, I'm afraid this house is $48,000, son.
Right.
No, you wouldn't get the swimming pool.
Yeah, no, the garage, right. So, Aston.
Yeah, this is a DB2. It was my dad's car. He ordered it from
This very one
was my dad's car.
How'd you track that down?
I didn't. I found it by accident. I took a good friend of mine to an Aston Martin restorer in Switzerland because he had to pick up his DB4. And then I saw this disassembled in a horrible, like, spray can metallic green. And somebody had put a Corvette style, a 64 style Corvette rear window, you know, one piece wraparound like the split window, but no split. And the car was an abortion. And I said, well, gee, what a shame. My dad had a DB2. And he said, oh, really? And I said, yeah, but his was blue. And he showed me the inside of the hood, and it was blue. And then I said, yeah, but my dad's had these specially made spring steel bumpers that he had installed at the factory because he didn't like the fact of parking it with no bumpers. And the guy reaches into a box and pulls out these bumpers. Then I said, yeah, but my dad's also had a specially crafted aluminum drop box under the pedal because my dad had big feet and his toes were fouling the steering and the wiring and everything. And he reaches into another box and said, the box somewhat like this. Then we went and checked. He got this file out and opened the file. Sure enough, there was the original build order made out to Herr Generaldirektor Robert Halutz, H instead of A. I still have the original simulated leather-bound owner's manual, which is sort of a nice green thing, in there with my dad's notes from oil changes and spark plug cleanings because it had these KLG platinum tip plugs, but they were 10 millimeter plugs. And they fouled a lot because I asked the Aston Martin engineer, I said, why do your plugs foul so often? And he said, well, because we have racing tolerances in the engine. I said, I see. Why? And he said, because the engine was developed for racing. And I said, But the customers have to clean the plugs all the time. And the way my dad drives, You know, he stops for a second at a stoplight, and when he starts again, he's on five cylinders. He says, well, you know, you must keep the revs up.
That's simple enough.
Yeah. So whenever I drove it, I'd be at the stoplight going, wrappin', 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 wrappin'. And everybody thought, look at that crazy young kid. I was just keeping the plugs clean.
I'll think of that excuse the next time I'm revving them up.
But it's exactly the way my dad had it. It's back to the original Aston Martin color. You know, we were able to get the codes. We were back to the original, same Connolly leather in light gray with blue piping. So I can honestly say, when I bought it, my dad was still alive. And I said, guess what I did today, Dad? And he said, I don't know. What did you do? I said, I bought your old Aston Martin. He says, what? Why on earth would you want to do that? So I didn't tell him what I paid. He would have been really shocked at my fiscal irresponsibility.
That's really cool, though, that you were able to track this car down or really just stumble across it.
Stumble across is the word, yeah. And I bought it on the spot. I think the hood's closed, but at any rate, it's the W.O. Bentley-designed twin cam 6 that looks a lot like a Jag 6 because the same guy designed it. Then over here we have perhaps one of the most interesting cars, which, remember, at a recent period, we looked at the 1934 LaSalle.
Yeah.
That was 34. This is 34. And styling-wise, there's like two decades in between the cars. But in terms of...
This looking so much older, you mean?
Oh, yeah. But in terms of proportion... I just love this with the low overall height. I mean, the top of the radiator is probably almost half of what the LaSalle is. So in terms of proportion, this is very modern. It's got the very long dash to axle. And I love the way the radiator crouches behind the headlights, which are like raised fists. This is maybe one of the most original MPH Rileys in the world, of which only 18 were built. Most of the others were restored with Lucas P1.
Right.
But this has the original Riley badges in the headlight. These are not Lucas P1s. They were designed specifically for Riley. Everything about this car is original. It's obviously fully restored, but it's an old restoration. It was restored in 1972. And we can take a quick look at the engine. It's also a twin cam. As you can see, all aluminum.
Now, that's a cool header.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's one of the reasons it sounds so good, because they're equal length exhaust track. Now, one of the tests I say to people, show me where the camshaft drive is. And
is that down in the block?
Yeah, they're in the block. There's two cams, but they're in the block. It's in a way very similar to what the BMW 328 was, where they got a Hemi head, but they did it with one overhead cam and then little push rods that went across the engine. This actually is two cams with little lifters and little push rods, basically creating a Hemi head. So it's a twin cam, but they're not overhead.
Ha! Huh. That's
different. So you don't see it drive.
And what's this area between the engine compartment and the cockpit?
That's for the driver's legs.
Oh.
and then in here you've got, storage.
I guess that's what I'm looking at. I've never seen storage like that before. Not much, but
no, but
you still have something there.
Because all this area down here is
for
the driver's legs.
Your feet.
Now this is, what do you think these are? These plywood boxes.
I gotta believe you kept your owner's manual in
no,
there or something.
The racing screens.
Oh.
The racing
that
screens.
That is so cool. I've never seen that
and
before.
Then you flip the little latch down. You know, you slide them in, then you flip this little chrome latch down to prevent them from sliding out.
Unbelievable.
And note all the cast aluminum parts. Everything is low volume cast aluminum, including the fan.
The fan.
Aluminum casting. None of that stamped stuff. This engine needs a cleanup, I'm afraid. It needs, because it's raw aluminum, needs polishing every so often. But and this car has, look at the size of the brakes.
They're gigantic.
Yeah, and they're magnesium drums with steel linings. So that's for reduced unsprung weight. And the brakes are adjustable from the driver's seat. It was designed for long-distance racing. And actually, Riley wanted to get at least a class win with this car because they'd done so well with the smaller Riley Imp. And then they thought, well, if we do a bigger car with a six-cylinder engine, we probably can get ourselves way up in the standings. As it was one of these things where bigger wasn't better, and the car was never more successful than the Riley Imp had been, which was a very successful race car. The Riley Imp, by the way, would last long races with a two main bearing crankshaft. They had a main bearing at each end, and inside there, nothing was supported. This is a three main bearing six. There's a main bearing at either end and one center main, so there's three throws on either side. But the engine revs nicely. It also has a semi-automatic transmission where it's called Wilson Pre-Selector, where you always pre-select the next gear you know you're going to use. And then when you actually want that gear, you just touch the clutch and it shifts.
Cool. This is this is very rare car.
This is very rare, and I've been following this car ever since I was a teenager. I knew where it was, and I finally had a chance to buy it.
We got some questions here. Should we do some of that?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, Bob, we got a number of questions from the audience here. Ray Schaffer says, do you miss not having your early Dodge Vipers? And what are your thoughts about the new Viper and it being labeled as an SRT?
I didn't like the intermediate Viper. First of all, yes, I miss my Vipers, but you can't keep everything. And, my loyalty to GM sort of demanded that I not drive them. So why own a car that you can't drive? I like the new Viper a lot. I didn't like the one in between. I thought the one in between was an aberration, wound up looking more like a C5 Corvette. The new one is back to the distinctive styling. It's back to where the Viper is. It's that Viper design heritage. The coupe has some lovely little elements of visual interest with the little extractor vent in the back and everything. I just think it's a fabulous job. Love the car.
And calling it SRT?
So?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, why not? I agree.
Chrysler calls car after car 300. What's with SRT that you're not allowed to use it?
Okay, Pig wants to know, what's your favorite car currently in production, or what are you most looking forward to?
My favorite car currently in production, to be totally honest, is a split vote between the Chevy Volt and the ZR1. And the thing I'm looking forward to most is the next ZR1.
Peter's been talking a lot about that one, too. Jay Cujo says, write another book.
It's on the way. It's almost finished.
About? Can you give us a preview?
It's about leaders I have known, their strong points, their weak points, and many anecdotes describing their weak points. But it's not a hatchet job in that I always, in the concluding every chapter, I sort of do an assessment from the employees' and shareholders' perspective, and even though the gentleman may have displayed some odd behavior, at the end of the day, what did he do for the shareholder? So I think it's a book that people are going to say, I didn't know you could act that nutty and be CEO of a major corporation. But at the end of the day, I basically, with one exception, I come out with pretty fulsome praise for all my subjects. I think it's going to be, let me put it this way. If you liked Car Guys versus Bean Counters, you're going to love Icons and Idiots.
That's the name, Icons and Idiots?
It's the working title.
It's a good working title.
Yeah, whether the publisher stays with it or not, I don't know.
Let's see here. We've got another one. Ray Aran wants to know about transonic combustion. Has anyone verified their fuel economy improvement claims of 25%?
Yeah, the fuel economy claims are there without question, but there's much work needs to be done on injector durability, injector reliability, cost, and so forth. So it's almost ready for prime time, but not yet. But the basic technology works.
Cool. Good to know. Matt Boshi says, will you be attending the Concours d'Elegance this weekend in Plymouth?
No.
Okay, so I won't ask you what car you're going to bring there either. Dan from Riverside says, is the Cadillac ATS primarily a European/Chinese play? He says, nice car, but do we need that size in the U.S.?
Sure we do, because most Audi owners think that the current A4 is a little bit too big. They like the old A3, the old A4 better. BMW is being careful not to increase the size of the 3 because that's the size that people like. The CTS was basically a 4 series. You know, we sold it for the price of a 3, but it was in the eyes of many buyers of entry-level European luxury cars said the CTS was too big and too heavy. Do something like that. Do something that's like a BMW 3, and we'll start getting serious about it. So no, the car is designed primarily for the U.S., and it's in the U.S. that it'll generate 80% of its sales.
So I got to ask you, while we're down to the last few minutes here, what's your assessment of GM now that you can step back and look back?
Well, I think I think it's being well led. They're not doing everything the way I would do it, but on the other hand, some of this stuff probably needed changing. And I think it's very well led. I think Mary Barra is doing a great job in product development. Design has certainly continued on the same trajectory we set, and I'm pleased that every time I see a new GM car, whether it's a Chevy Sonic or a Cruze or now the Cadillac XTS, I see that that number one lesson that I tried to drive, which is excellence in execution, panel fits, paint, gaps, sounds of door closing, of
switches. Proportions.
Yeah, that has been retained, and nobody is ever, I don't think, going to compromise the product in the interest of per unit profitability at GM anymore.
Yeah.
And it's paying off. I mean, look at the Sonic is a huge success. So you can't make great food using cheap ingredients.
Peter, anything, last thoughts? Or
No, I'm glad design GM is, the design renaissance continues.
Yeah, I check in with Ed Welburn every now and then and say, are you continuing to get support? And he says, I am continuing to get all the support I need.
So. And we'll see the new Corvette in Detroit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's going to surprise a lot of people. It's radically different, but it looks great.
Well, look, it's been great having you take us around your garage and show us all your collection. We need you to get you back in the studio at some point.
Sure,
and we'll
absolutely.
Just talk about your new book and more about what you see going on.
That might be over a year, before they finally publish it, but I'll come in any old time.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well,
thanks, Bob.
Yeah.
Hey, good to
Peter,
see you.
Always good to see you.
Yeah. Bob, thanks so much. It's really cool seeing all these cars.
And thank you, crew, for your able support.
Thank you. Yeah, and Peter and I will be back here next week, folks, so join us then.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Chevrolet. Chevy runs deep.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.